My name is Charlene Deal, and I'm the director of this Whiz Bang Festival, and I'm so glad you've joined us tonight. If you've been here other evenings, welcome back. If this is your first evening main stage, welcome here. I'm glad you've joined us for the Poetry Bash. It's always our Saturday night tradition, and it's a time of great joy for many of us, especially those of us who love poetry, whether we read it or write it or both. You've already heard this before, but if it's your first time, I'll just remind you, I want every single one of you to pick up your cell phone and look at it and make sure that it's turned off, because it's hard no matter what when the cell phone goes off, but it's really, really disruptive in the middle of a poem. Now, usually there's a little chorus of brrring. Nice. I'd like to take a second to acknowledge our sponsor for this evening's program, Friesens. The printer of choice across Canada is our sponsor for this evening, and the printer for that beautiful little paperback that most of you have in your backpacks. Let's acknowledge Friesens. I've been thinking about this evening since last year on the last Saturday of the festival, because the Poetry Bash is that place where we get to make a big, warm, celebratory performance space for people who make poetry. And it occurred to me as I was walking through my day that one of the things that I rarely remember to say, but I will remember tonight, is that there's a kind of challenge in terms of audience etiquette when you listen to a poet, because a poet works often in smaller units. So there's that hesitation after the end of a poem. Do you clap? Do you not clap? Do you clap? Do you not clap? So I'm going to recommend that you get by with sighs, groans of pleasure, ecstasy, whatever, but withhold the clapping until the end of the presentation for each of these poets, because there is a way in which each of the poems begins to resonate with the other poems, and if there's a lot of interruptions, we miss some of that echoing. So that just relieves you if you're one of those people who feels responsible for the social grace of the moment. I've just relieved you of the pressure. I think of a really interesting critic that I read, probably 30 years ago when I was at grad school and trying to figure out how to write about poetry, who said, "Poetry is an act of attention." And I've kind of held on to that idea for my whole life. And I think sometimes the attention that a poet makes is attention to language, or attention to a moment in a life, or attention to a thing or a place or an image or an idea. And each of the poets on tonight's show has a different way of paying attention. Some of them are playful, some of them are serious, some of them are both at the same time. We get to open this evening with a local poet who's been a favorite of mine for some time, since I came back in 2000. She's a live wire, and she's a really good poet, and I was just delighted that this year her first collection has been released. It's called Wolf Tree. Please welcome Alison Calder.
Thank you very much, Charlene. And thank you as well to all the people who make the Writers' Festival happen. I've been lucky enough to be able to sit in the audience many times. This is my first time up on the stage, and you all look a lot more scary from up here, I must say, than you do out there. So as Charlene was saying, Wolf Tree is my first collection, and it's divided into a number of sections. And the sections are grouped roughly thematically, but I think a lot of the poems speak to each other. So tonight I'm going to read just several poems that are drawn from different parts of the collection. One of my preoccupations with this collection was the idea of the outsider, people and animals who were considered to be outside the norm for some reason. And I was really drawn to these characters because they tell us so much about what people think about what it is to be human, to look at people who are considered to be not human, and to consider like what makes them that way. And a number of the poems that I worked on for this book have to do with historical figures, people and animals who were considered to be freaks, and some of whom worked as freaks. And I want to start off by reading a couple of poems about a character named Zip. And I'll just give you the background on Zip, and then I'll read you a couple poems about him. Zip was also known as the What Is It? And Zip was the stage name of William Henry Johnson, an African-American from Brooklyn, who was discovered by P.T. Barnum in 1859. Johnson, who suffered from microcephaly, was marketed as both a wild man, he was considered to be half human and half ape, and also as a pinhead. That was his market niche, I guess, if you want to put it that way. There is evidence to suggest that he was nowhere near as disabled as Barnum, Ringling, and other onlookers supposed, as is indicated by his final words, which conclude the poem that I'm going to read for you now. The poem's called Zip. The joke with Zip was this. He thought he ran the show. He'd mimic Ringling, smoking a cigar and shouting orders from the sideshow stage. He'd strut and fire the other freaks. The Rubes and Ringling laughed. They knew who was boss. When Zip tossed back the change, crowds threw him in performance. They said it proved him stupid, and so they bought more tickets. Before Zip died, he opened his eyes, said, "Well, we sure fooled him for a long time." Zip the nondescript, stupid pinhead Zip, pulling his shaggy suit over everybody's eyes. Now, people who worked as circus freaks often had a number of publicity photos taken of themselves, and they would sell these photographs to crowds sometimes. And they were a source of endless fascination for photographers who had a kind of a scientific curiosity and also a kind of voyeurism. People were very interested in seeing these sort of freakish bodies. And a photographer named Charles Eisenman photographed many of the people who were working as freaks in the 1880s. And he has a photograph of Zip with another person who was working as a freak. And this other person was working as a leopard boy. And the leopard boy likely suffered from vitiligo, which you might also know is the condition that Michael Jackson supposedly has that turns him white. So I found this photograph, and this poem is about that. And it starts off with a quotation from a book called Monsters of the Gilded Age. The following year, a celebrated incident gave Zip an additional name. The Prince of Wales, later Edward VII, visited the U.S. and toured the American Museum with Barnum. When they came upon Zip, the astonished prince turned to his host and asked, "What is it?" So here's my description of that photograph. "I give you Zip, what is it? Pinhead, black, inexplicably adorned with a pendant of George Washington, in shaggy suit, gorilla-like, putting up his dukes. Across the grass, which close inspection reveals to be a rug, a piebald black, the leopard boy, whose singlet gapes to show his pinto skin, the negro turning white. Zip has the upper hand. Behind them could be clouds or a volcano and a path that Zip is blocking. His furry arm repels the other's stride. No advance for the leopard boy, his fist in a white boxing glove dragging Zip's dark shadow. If you could fold this photograph in half, you would discern the body of a butterfly, each wing inscribed with text that flashes, beautifully, the hard black rules that govern daily life. The body is the hinge that swings the mirror, the binding of the book that tells you who you get to be, the photograph that shows you what's not human. Zip and the leopard boy and Zip, two sides of the coin, I toss to you." So after I was looking at these historical figures, I started to look a little bit closer at home. I'm very interested in the kind of freakishness in the domestic, the sort of uncanniness in everyday life. And one of the freak animals that I sort of seized upon was my father's dog, Taffy. Now, Taffy was a horrible dog. He had few redeeming qualities. He barked, he ate things, he was untrainable, he ran away, he got into the garbage, he would dig through your bag and he would like drag your underwear out and carry it around the house. He was just really a horrible dog. But my father loved him. He loved the dog. And he was always inventing this sort of personality for Taffy where Taffy loved opera. You know, if only Taffy could sing Nessun Dorma, you know, how happy he would be. Or, you know, like Taffy was always going out and leaving these P-mail messages, you know, for other dogs in the neighborhood and so on. So my father really gave Taffy this kind of voice. And I suppose the fact that my father loved Taffy so much, well, I guess it speaks well of my father's charitable nature, which is not often seen in other cases, actually, now that I think about it. But anyway, I decided I would write about Taffy, because if my father could give Taffy a voice, you know, maybe I should do the same thing. So I thought about, you know, what would Taffy say if he could say, what would our pets say to us? What's going on in their heads? So the poem is called Speak Taffy, Taffy Speaks. Daily I protect the house, intercept everything unworthy of you, bills from credit cards, property tax assessments, letters from ungrateful offspring. These I chew and swallow before regurgitating beneath the peonies. You must not be disturbed by cats. It is the least that I can do. I pray you walk me. If I could burst this leash, I'd fetch you rotten apples, pee mightily upon your stair. All hail, the king is here. Long live the king. At 4 o'clock, I dance on my short legs, bark glyphic syllables to a fluorescent moon. I pray, and dinner comes, kibbles again, the joy. Yet I am a bad dog, the kibbles rattle in my small tin dish. I must be better, do all I can. I must not gorge on garbage after supper. Pray you do not know till later. Soon, dog basket isolation, my pillow cold. All night I watch your bed, loathing my short legs. If I were better, you would love me more. You snore, oh growling symphony, the hordes of thoughts I want to speak. Did I not love you quite so desperately, I would kill you as you sleep. And he would have, you know. I mean, he had that kind of streak in him, I think. Of course, Taffy is no more, so we're all safe. Now, another section in this book deals with my home neighborhood. In Winnipeg, I live in Wolseley, which is a neighborhood that I love very much. And it's also a neighborhood with a number of things going on beneath the surface. It's a neighborhood that's going through a lot of changes. And as a homeowner, I'm very happy to see a lot of those changes happening. But as someone who worries about social justice issues, I'm not quite so sure about... I'm concerned about who's paying the cost, I guess, for the changes that are going on. So I just want to read one poem from that section, which is called Wolseley. And I just want to say I really do love Wolseley. Okay, no matter what you think about this, I love Wolseley. Wolseley. In the garden, a nice life if you can get it, catastrophic failure in the cone flowers, black rot moving up the stems. The lily's sunny regiment folds like sniper victims. Irises, past bloom, are holding strong for now, but underground, who knows? Blight multiplies by air or water. Still, the bees are flying back and forth and back and forth, flower to hive to flower, like planes lined up on the flight path, like stitches pulled through fabric, like men who move all night long through back alleys, rummage through each dumpster, looking for something, anything, to sell or eat. Now, it's not all doom and gloom in Wolseley. Some of you may know that my husband is also a writer, Warren Carew, and many people are fascinated by this, by two writers living in the same house. You know, how can it possibly be? Are you competitive? You know, who does all the work? Well, I can tell you that right now, but anyway, who does all the work? Do you fight about getting writing time? And, you know, I think these people are just trying to stir up trouble. But just to sort of settle people's questions, I have written a poem about that, being with a writer, and it's called Your Muse is Visiting. Your muse is visiting. Again. She's a bad guest, demands attention at all hours. She dirties the dishes and never cleans a cup, wears your clothes and never does the wash. She won't even give you time to buy the groceries. Your muse won't stay in the guest room. She hangs a do not disturb sign on your door. Also, please make up this room. Think a dog is bad? Try making love with a muse in the bed. Your muse puts empty milk cartons back in the fridge, leaves wet towels on the floor, piles crockery in the sink. While the two of you talk about art, I wash her dirty sheets. Someday I'll let my husband read that poem out loud. I'm sure he could turn it around as well. I just want to read one more poem to close. And while I was writing this book, I spent some time up at my father's cottage. Well, cottage, what am I saying? I'm from Saskatchewan. We don't have cottage. It's a cabin. His cabin in northern Saskatchewan, by myself, for 2 weeks. And I'd never been up there by myself before. And being up there by myself meant that I had to do all of the labor that kind of keeps the cabin going. Usually I can sort of sucker other people into making pancakes and, you know, chopping the wood and things like this. But when I was up there by myself, I had to chop the wood, which I'd never done before. And I was a little bit apprehensive about the whole thing, axe, my leg, that kind of connection I didn't want to have happen. But I discovered I really liked chopping the wood. There was something very satisfying about, like, first you have a big piece of wood, and then at the end of it, you have, like, something has changed. You have a bunch of smaller pieces. It was very satisfying. And also a good way to get out aggression. So I wrote a poem about that. It's called, "She Teaches Herself to Chop Wood by Reading Poetry." Aim for the point that everything circles. There will be space to let you in. At a certain moment, a decision is irreversible, the weighted blade dropping itself to impact. You know people who've cut themselves with their own axes. Admire the pieces, how you can't put them together to make a tree. Thank you.
That's Allison Calder. The next guest lived here in Winnipeg when I did not, so it's been a great delight for me to meet him for the first time. He's been living in Toronto for some period. He writes in French, and he writes in English. He's also a musician. He's a lovely reader, performer, thinker, dreamer. Please welcome Paul Savoy. Okay, we need emergency help up here. Are you okay? Yeah, it just like that's the dance part. Thank you.
You have to really stake out the joint before you. good evening, bonsoir. I'm going to read you bits and pieces from different books. I kind of wanted to go back to some of my early books and sort of move into the more recent ones. The earliest book that I had published in English is something called Acrobats. And this is the title poem. We could hang from the rafters, do double somersaults on the beam, let the acrobats that we are shuffle on the wire, pirouette along the edge. You are the magician on the platform. Our domed universe dissolves underneath the caped layers of your wizardry, and we dance on the rim of the hat that you swirl through the crevices. We could swing across the gulf, wear hoops like life belts over storms, let the acrobats that we dream up grab hold of jettison's bars, free fall through the open chute. You are the fowler, weaving the illusion of winged space. We fly inside the web of clouds and dust that covers the dome like pebbles on a frozen stretch of a caged sky. We dance on the ocean, fish in a net of air, trapeze artists dangling above the glass, above the glare of footlights. Your hands tremble when we grab hold in midair. The child. The child's heart at birth hung outside the body. The gypsy woman placed a leaf on the beating heart and closed the child's dead eyes with smooth stones. She placed the child inside a narrow grove. She covered the child's limbs with a cloak of hemp and marigold, columbines and wild strawberries. The child's heart sank into the earth's heart to form red eiderdown. The leaf turned to brown. The child's eyes were jarred open by moving earth beneath the neck, where roots of a willow pushed upward. Water sprang from the earth as the willow tree gave out its first shade to the child. The child's face rested against the stones which had fallen from the eyes. One stone had the color of the bluebird. One was a moonstone. One stone had the shape of a ring. One was a dark pebble. One stone had the emblem of the sea. The child tossed the stones into the air above him, and as they touched the sky and the earth, he heard the first sound of the life of the universe. He laughed at the strangeness of the sound. Then he closed his eyes. He reached into the pool of water and searched among the reeds. In his palm appeared a red, bulbous form having the shape of a heart. The heart was reflected on the surface of the water. The sky took the color of the water's surface, and the child cried out in fear when the shadow of the willow tree began to disappear. From the Meaning of Gardens. Thunder claps. So many riveters all in a row to form barbed wire blue. Small strips of fabric hang across the expanse as if all wars had their clothesline, with human effigies patched together in sagging parallels. I hang, am hung, pins between your teeth before you spread me out, sockets for where you clip me to the landscape. Gophers take me for a scarecrow in the dangling dawn. The thunder that snaps does not forewarn of storms. It ignites the blowtorch that men raise in unison. The fence the universe once passions unfurl. A single outburst releases each fire in succession in the narrow tunnel. The long, narrow chamber of small fire forms a chain. Clothes flap in the crossfire. A poem in French from a book called Racine d'eau, Water Roots, or Roots of Water. And this is about the sky being a mushroom, actually. And the word champignon in French is much more poetic than the word mushroom in English. Le ciel est un champignon. Il faut que je lui trouve un champ ou une forêt bien apprise aux ombres favorables. Le ciel est un champignon. Il faut que je lui trouve une rosée et qu'autour de lui pousse des gerbes aux couleurs appropriées. Le ciel est un champignon. Il faut qu'un jour il puisse reposer dans ma main quand j'aurai besoin de lui pour l'offrir à un être aussi affamé que moi. And from Fishing for Light. Too many buckets, my child. The sea cannot withstand your castle frenzy, piles upon piles of sand packed in all the strata you can muster, so many layers for one small stretch of beach. Leaning towers upset the balance, tiny windows gum up the works. Soon the sea will be turned inside out. Your arms are strong enough to take in the waves, the energy locked inside each arching dome. What will you have accomplished, impetuous one, when clanking bells from submerged ships resound in deafening matins? Amphibians and crustaceans will wander aimlessly across the stilled bed. Nothing will be contained in the mirrorless sky. Birds in their descent will lose their bearings. They will dive into a delayered mass beneath their claws, mistaking prey for an insubstantial wiggling thing. Resort to frenzied circles, cease forever to plummet and to call. Return the water to the sea. Your desire threatens the tide. The moon will be ensnared by the crooked gates, the drawbridge, the moat, dismantle walls, stairs, turret. Your dungeons suck the landscape in. Empty the insidious bucket. Rolling waves are more precious than your dream. Dig a simple pool instead. Be content with little mounds. Do not go near the sea, my child. Lie next to me quietly on the sand. Do not look outward. You must not reach. You must not touch. Do not empty out the sea. And to close off, something that was inspired by taking a hike on the Niagara Escarpment. There is a climb, she says, a way to move your body so the cliff simply punctuates the horizon, a way to reach the path. The escarpment in each sighting cradles your skin with currents of scent and longing. You wear the landscape the way dancers shed their skin in the variegated glare. There is a shift, she says, a stripping of bark, an aperture between walls of shadow, embers of light in open palms, an embrace as when wind curls around the fallen leaf. There is the place, she says. You lean into the blue, so far into the diaphanous There is the place, she says. You lean into the blue, so far into the diaphanous mass. You tilt the empty space in the direction of a single word, parted lips in the act of unfolding. Curtains flap outward, gather muted voices into an utterance so distilled and pure, the unsuspecting bird of prey, passing along the edges, etches itself forever into the canvas, gathers you into its breath, its flight, to the farthest reaches of your gaze. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Paul Savoie. Merci, Paul. When I very first took on this job 5 years ago now, within about a week, I zipped off to a conference far away in Calgary, which is very far away. And I heard a bunch of poets there, which is always fun for me. And amongst them was a poet that just made me laugh and made me think really hard, and made me wonder about what all is possible in this genre we call poetry. And I did manage to get him to come right off the bat to this festival. And then a couple of years later, he was traveling in Canada again. So I managed to work out an exhibit of his very beautiful visual poems. You might remember those. And this year, he's back in Canada, and I'm very glad to have him at the microphone again. He's a British-born poet with Hungarian roots and a Portuguese passport. Please welcome John Havelda.
Oh, hello, good evening. And it's great to be back in Winnipeg. And thank you, Charlene, and the team for putting together this terrific festival. It's always such a pleasure. I'd like to begin with an epigraph. It's from the American poet Jack Spicer. The poet likes to think he's a pitcher, but really he's a catcher. Nice. Two short poem film scripts to begin with. Feature-length poem. A man walks into a cinema. He sits down next to himself and asks himself for a light. He lights his cigarette himself. He's come to see a film about himself in which he has a bit part. Carnal outsider. Lights come up in a cinema. All alone, a couple get up to leave. He sulks at the film's obscurity. A week passes. Lights come up in a theater. All alone, the same couple get up to leave. He is straining to control his anger at the impenetrability of the play. A week passes. In the dark, a bed creaks irregularly. A bedside lamp is switched on. The man, wild with anger, whispers through his bared teeth, "What the Christ is that supposed to mean?" I'd like to read my new book, which is this box. And I've been very fortunate to work with the Canadian poet that many of you, I'm sure, know, Fred Waugh, who was here before last year, wasn't it, Charlene? Right. And so I've been very fortunate to become friends with Fred, and we've worked on a number of projects. And this is one of them, and this was published about a week ago. So it's a deck of cards. And on the front is a paired portrait of boys in draw pools. And on the back are short, very short texts. And Fred and I were thinking about institutional constraints, the ways in which institutions put people into drawers. And also we were thinking about in-betweenness and pairing. So this book can be read in the arbitrary order that you find it, or if you so desire, you can rewrite it by cutting it or shuffling it to any other arbitrary order. This is not a message. M-O-O-M, home. Not one or two emotions, but the whole gamut. Enantioseme. Neither I know him, nor does he. Bridge to the bridge. The ever-intrusive adjective. Unlike Jeff, teaches Fred. Head boy. Clean an ablative. Au revoir. Wary possums broach whimsy. Avoid expressions huge and strange. De fei fat da. Fainally. Profit motive. Udvariotlon avariadu. Atypism. Dig veed, dig it, weed, dogged word. Briar my joy. Fanboys. Eat at the heart table. A fine sight now with the bright twins. Ext. E tempus. And a fist period. Henslet. What does that mean, contain? I'll contain you, young man. Whenever the following truth. Next two complete thoughts. Hence the A. Common noun. Oz, oz. Several P's, Q. Larkin' about, it ain't. The contemptible philosophy of duty shirking. Ubu buys Enola Gay. Boy and yob, yob and boy. Pronoun, anti-adjective. Perfect, prefect. Deprivals. In detention. I Sylvia so. Canvas gist grist jig. Verb sink tapping. Okor porost. Conjunction, junction. Leave no stone turned. Abomination, miscegenate. More truth immediately, then tables. the smell of here-ness and the aftertaste. Make sure you understand instead. Forget the. To make the internal eternal. And what charm there is in the pluperfect subjunctive. I can't contain yourself. Number one rule before the sentence, no T, but. Jew, papist. Duplicity. Warp aging. Behave yet. Sick note within. Onidance. Enthy me, me. Just enough rope. I the raw. Duodene. Me as soon as you. Finally the conjunction. Sing, 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 sing. I want to do it suddenly if I don't have money. Reflect, reflex. Meanwhile, five lectures on the branch. Address or a store? What, if any? Homeless, my love's embodiment. Kingdom, went. Webbed feet so swimmingly. Ent instead of ain't. Two signs and a slow squirrel. After this, you. I know a letter represents a statement. Un navegant e un trabajador. But appears at the start. They're both for China. If you follow besides, return the list because bearded fry, topos mantling arbung the rosebush, everlasting sentences ended. Keeping fit the ear, a poor poise, a throat. Fecete, fecete. Hand in hand and in. I'd like to read another book, a bit more like a book. It's a short, long poem or a long, short poem. It's called Echo and Narcissus, and it's a rewriting of that myth. Co was a full nymph, fond of the woods and hills where she ted self to land sports. She was a right of Na and ed her in the chase, but Co had one ing. She was fond of ing, and her in chat or ment would have the last word. One day, no, was ing her band, who she had son to fear, was ing self, mong the nymphs. Co, by her talk, ived to tame the s, till the nymphs made their cape. When no veered it, she past tense pon co in these words. You shall fate the use of that tongue with words you have ted me, except for that one pose you are so fond of, ply. You shall still have the last word, but no to speak first. This nymph saw us, a full youth, as he sued the chase on the Thames. She loved him and owed his steps. Oh, how she longed to dress him in the test sense and win him to verse. But it was not in her She ted with shunts for him to speak first and had her swear die. One day the youth ing ted from his once ted loud. Who's here? Clo lied here. Us looked round, but ing no one called out. Come, Co sword come. As no one came, us called gain. Why do you shun me? Co asked the same shun. Let us join one there, said the youth. The maid sword with all her heart in the same words and eaned to the spot. Die to throw her arms out his neck. He ted back ing. Hands off, I would there die, then you should have me. Have me, she said, but it was all in vain. He left her and she went to hide her S in the S of the woods. From that time forth, she lived in caves and mong tane cliffs, her form ed with grief, till at last all her flesh shrank away. Her bones were changed to rocks, and there was thing left of her but her voice. With that she is still die, to ply, to nigh, one who calls her and keeps up her old bit of ing, the last word. Tie, in this case, was not the lie stance. He shunned all the rest of the nymphs, as he had done poor Co. One day a den who had in vain vored to tract him, teared a prayer that he might sometime or there feel what it was to love and meet no turn of shun. The ing s heard and ted the prayer. There was a clear tain with tur like ver to which the herds drove their flocks, nor the tain goats ted, nor nigh of the beasts of the est. There was it faced with n leaves or chess, but the grass grew fresh round it, and the rocks turred it from the sun. There came one day the youth, eagued with ing, ted, and sty. He stooped down to drink and saw his own age in the tur. He thought it was some full it, ing, in the tain. He stood, ing, with shun, at those bright eyes, those locks, curled like the locks of us or lo, and dead cheeks, the wry neck, the ted lips, and the glow of health and size are all. He fell in love with self. He brought his lips near to take a kiss. He plunged his arms in to brace the loved ject. It fled at the touch, but turned gain to ament and nude the shun. He could not tear self way. He lost all thought of food or rest while he veered the brink of the tain, ing on his own age. He talked with the posed it. Why, full ing, do you shun me? Lie, my face is not one to pell you. The nymphs love me, and you self look not rent on me. When I stretch forth my arms, you do the same, and you smile on me and swear my ings with the like. His tears fell to the tur and turbed the age. As he saw it part, he claimed, stay, I treat you. Let me at least gaze upon you, if I may not touch you. With this and much more of the same kind, he ished the flame that sumed him, so that by degrees he lost his law, his gore, and the tie which lie had so charmed the nymph Co. She kept near him veer, and when he claimed lass, lass, she sworded him with the same words. He pined way and died, and when his shade passed the Gean veer, it leaned veer the boat to catch a look at self in the turs. The nymphs mourned for him, li the nymphs, and when they smote their breasts, Co smote hers so. They paired a ral pile and would have burned the die, but it was where to be found. But in its place a whirl in the dead with white leaves, which bears the name and erves the rye of us. I'll just read two more short poems. I'd like to read one from this book, which I like, he said modestly, because you get three poems on one page like this. So you can read them individually or you can read them simultaneously and let the poems that are beneath the other ones bleed through. And I prefer that latter way of reading.
Quem se interessa por Ted, estas garotas, estas... por rapazes modernos que vê, querem tudo, falam de husky, tudo, sabem de tudo, hound of ever, terno amigo corajoso, ing, a trabalhador incansável, bl, muito digno, caráter rígido, não exageradamente piegas, e now, finalmente, vencedor, gassy, excess, é assim que eu, tal, and desejo homem.
That is the kind of man I desire. And to finish, I'd just like to read a poem. I was asked once to contribute to a journal that was going to publish all of these poems on erotica. And not knowing a lot about that subject, I came up with this. And parental guidance is not recommended here. Sein Lene Rock. Hypnotique, nautique, batique, but yoke, oak, hip-hop, scotch on the rock, Saint Lane, rock, kikwaz, asinine to the nines, tether nouns, noons on us, none of us, awful felonies, knees nasally, navel evil oval teenies, matinees, Martinique, Tiluk, in all the wrong places, sung spaces, time and again, gangster, hamster, hamstring, hanging by a thread, a threnody Kennedy, noddy thread, dithramb, and ramble through the brambles, bells of Belain, ballistic, misspelt, spoilt, written, bratata, ratazanatizan, Byzantium, auntie M, antioch, ochre, ogre, over, very virtuous cheese, just ease, justice, just is, just in, the steins, just eaten to say, to sanity, sanitary, military lines, will a tree trundle, trestle, wrestle, nestle, lie low down and dirty, earth, kit it, pretty, pity, piously shy, biography, graphite, you write, he, she, it requites, quits its querulous rulers, less essence, Amelia, Elia, illicit, ilka, can, cane, kin, cane, an analogy, knowledge, edgily, eerily, wearily, wear a leotard, retard, tardily, tidily, toddle on, tottering, tearing, étrangering, red herring, harangue, outan, atone, attain, a train of thought, methought, purport, apropos, a proposal, a colossal illusion, collusion, elision, collegia, ligera, ribera, aberrant, berated, collated, colluge, colluge, colusely oozing along. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Every year, Prairie Fire, as you well know, one of the treasured institutions in the literary community here, runs a series of contests. And every year, many, many people send in prose, nonfiction, and poetry. And every once in a while, a contest like that surprises everyone by introducing a poet that no one had encountered before. And that is the case this year. The winner of the Prairie Fire Poetry Prize is Tricia Cull, who's a poet from Victoria. And she's going to read her winning entry, after which Andras Taskins and Perry Grosshans will present her with a very special prize. Please welcome Tricia Cull.
It is a little more scary up here. Allison was joking backstage that the furniture was for sale afterwards. So if it is, it's very nice. I'm in the process of moving, so. I'm just going to read the one poem. And I'd like to thank Prairie Fire for bringing me out and to be in the company of such great writers. It's an honor. I'll do a bit of a preamble. I was on the mainland in Vancouver, and my mother and I had been shopping, actually, and I had just purchased my wedding dress, in fact. And so I was on the ferry back and sitting there with my wedding dress in tow at night, and I knew, this doesn't really relate to the wedding dress, but I knew that I wanted to write a poem about terror or terrorism, and conversely freedom, these tag terms that we hear tossed around so much today in the media, and I think manipulated, but I'll leave it to your discretion as to why I was writing a poem about terror with my wedding dress in hand, but it's a noble institution I have a lot of respect for. Anyway, and so I was sitting there and with the pen to the paper, and I think many people who write will tell you the worst thing you can do is sit down and say, you know, I have to write a poem. I have to write a poem about, you know, terror or whatever it might be. But that's what I was doing, and I was distracted because every time I sort of got started, the captain would come on the speaker and say, would the owner of a blue Chevy, please return to the car deck, your dog has escaped. And I'm actually a big animal lover, but I was really annoyed and didn't care much for the dog and went back to my poem. And yet again, a little while later, the captain came on again and said, with the owner of, you know, a blue Chevy, please return to the car deck. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever traveled to between Vancouver and Vancouver Island, but people get annoyed at the constant announcements telling you to go to the buffet or enjoy the services on the main deck, which you're not obligated to do, by the way. But anyway, and so the third time I went to write the poem and, you know, the announcement came on again, you know, with the owner of a blue Chevy, please return to the car deck. Your dog has escaped. And it occurred to me, I guess sometimes poems happen that way, that was the poem, that there was this dog and sort of in a menacing situation, perhaps. It was night, and I just had the image of this dog out there, you know, at risk and perhaps wanting freedom. And so the poem started off to be, you know, grandly to be about this great ideology or concept that we hear so much about these days, and ended up being about a dog. So I think the dog, well, I won't tell you actually, but the poem is dedicated to the dog. And yeah, thanks for listening. It's called Loose. Spirit of Vancouver Island, a November crossing. The captain comes on the speaker and says, a dog's escaped from the car deck somewhere near the front of the ship. This, I think, is the announcement I've been waiting for. The animal loosed at the bow, unleashed between the foredeck guardrails, poised, sniffing the wind, the salt, padded paws gauging the dark, the tilt of the vessel's slippery list. How did she make it out? Was it through a Chevy window, left open just enough? A weak link in a chain? A frayed rope? Or a thin leather collar worn through to her scruff. I understand such rabid tendencies. What desire exceeds every kept creature's torment? No one should own a dog the way no one should own music. This ship slips through the narrows of active pass, as the mind, bound by thought's implacable meaning, slips into its own dark passage. Honed by the dull exterior of physical experience, fear has never been more piqued by ordinary details. Flat gray carpet, linoleum gleaming under track lighting, bleak Canadian faces longing for sunlight, fingerprints smudged against the plexiglass night. In the distance, the Queen of Esquimalt floats past, a relief vessel from Departure Bay, a lost birthday cake drifting into acquiescence. Are we all not on our way somewhere? Even the glossy pictures of orcas on the wall outside the Pacific Buffet, the seemingly flawless lines that divide the slick black skin from the slippery white, inspire in me a kind of horror, a duplicitous feeling of love and dread, of slowly being swallowed whole. For through such tiny teeth, I know my body could not pass. Everything gleams of conspiracy. Hovering outside, wings engaged in minor modulations of flight, a steel-eyed gull is fixed in time. Its white plume smoked by oil and soot, its steady pace, its nervous deliberation of sea and sky, its gaze set firmly on the horizon. Everything points to wanting peace, a place to land, but wanting also to keep up. Nearing the terminal, the spirit shudders, slows to a halt. As the engine grinds, rattles the espresso machines in the coffee shop, my mind takes to conjuring disaster, a wooden dock crushed to splinters, shattered plexiglass, cars, bodies plummeting to injury, obliteration, catharsis for the story of terror that belies us, morbid consolation for the apathetic way a harbor embraces a ship back home. I want to call it pain, a floodwater, a broken dam, the wall that is my heart, spilling over as darkness is spilling over the brow of Vancouver Island. I want to know what set the dog off, what lurch in the gut of the ship moved through her, what sudden heft moved through the vessel as the heft that lurched inside her heart. I know for certain all creatures sense freedom, the way they say some sense fear. And as my thoughts return to dark waters, I think I know this story too. No moon, no star, but the paddle of paws, the panting of breath, and the gentle opening of a wake in the darkness. Thank you.
We have really great poets for the second half, too. Very different sets of voices, as you've already seen so clearly. Every time a poet comes to the mic, a whole different sound emerges and a whole different way of constructing the universe. Our next poet is a poet who got recommended to me last year in a note from Patrick Friesen, who is a poet most of us here in Winnipeg still call our own, although he has not lived here for some time. He and Per Brask, who is a wonderful dramatic force in this city and has stayed here and continues to keep us all alive, had just finished a translation of the work by a Danish poet named Niels Hav and wondered if I would consider it. So I said, I'll consider anything. Send me some stuff. So I got a manuscript version more than a year ago, and I wrote back immediately and said, I would love to have this poet here if we can make it work. And so after a lot of months of tinkering around and sorting out arrangements with Denmark and various funding bodies in Canada, as well as a few of us festivals, we have this great pleasure of welcoming Niels Hav to Canada. Now, he almost got sick of the whole effort and called it quits because he got stuck in Frankfurt for who knows how long. So he kind of arrived looking bedraggled and bewildered and thinking, okay, am I finally in Canada? And so I would like all of you to give him a Winnipeg welcome. This is Niels Hav.
Thank you, Charlene. If it wasn't for Per Brask and Charlene, I would still be completely lost in this country. But I'm glad finally to be here. Per Brask and Patrick Friesen, my dear friends and translators, have been praising this city for me for many years. So now, finally, we are here. Epigram. You can spend your entire life in the company of words, not ever finding the right one. Just like a poor fish wrapped up in Hungarian newspapers. For one thing, it is dead. For another, it doesn't understand Hungarian. I'll take you on a bus ride. If in Winnipeg, it maybe could be bus number 11. In Copenhagen, it's bus number 40. Women of Copenhagen, I have once again fallen in love with, this time with five different women during a ride on the number 40 bus. How is one to gain control of one's life under such conditions? One of them were fur coat. Another read Wellingtons. One of them was reading a newspaper, the other Heidegger, and the streets were flooded with rain. At the boulevard, a dense princess entered the bus, euphoric and furious. I fell for her eagerly, but she jumped off at the police station and was replaced by two queens with flaming kerchiefs who spoke shrilly with each other in Pakistani all the way to the hospital, while the bus boiled in poetry. They were sisters and equally beautiful, so I lost my heart to both of them and plant a new life in a village near Rawalpindi, where the children grow up in a smell of hibiscus, while their desperate mothers sing heartbreaking songs as dusk settles over the Pakistani plains. But they didn't see me. And the one wearing a fur coat cried beneath her glow when I got off in Feimaxgade. The girl reading Heidegger suddenly shut her book and looked directly at me, as if she suddenly got a glimpse of Mr. Nobody in his very own insignificance. And that's how my heart broke for the fifth time when she got up and left the bus with all the others. Life is so brutal. I continued for two more stops before giving up. It always ends like that. You stand alone at the curb, sucking at a cigarette, wound up and mildly unhappy. My fantastic pen. I prefer writing with a used pen found in the street, or with a promotional pen, gladly one from the electrician, the gas station, or the bank. Not just because they are cheap, but I imagine that such a writing implement will fuse my writing with industry, the sweat of skilled laborers, administrative offices, and the mystery of all existence. Once I wrote meticulous poems with a fountain pen, pure poetry about purely nothing. But now I like shit on my paper, tears and snot. Poetry is not for sissies. A poem must be just as honest as a Dow Jones index, a pure mixture of reality and sheer bluff. What has one grown too sensitive for? Not much. That's why I keep my eye on the bond market and serious pieces of paper. And that's why I'm so happy about this ballpoint pen I found one dark night in front of a closed convenience store. It smells faintly of dog piss, and it writes fantastically. My father died many years ago. I'll bring him to Winnipeg tonight. Visit from my father. My dead father comes to visit and sits down in his chair again, the one I got. Well, Nils, he says. He's brown and strong. His hair shines like black liquor. Once he moved other people's gravestones around using a steel rod and a wheelbarrow. I helped him. Now he has moved his own by himself. How's it going, he says. I tell him all of it, my plans, all the unsuccessful attempts. On my bulletin board hang 17 bills. Throw them away, he says. They'll come back again. For many years, I was hard on myself, he says. I lay awake mewling to become a decent person. That's important. I offer him a cigarette, but he has stopped smoking now. Outside, the sun sets fire to roof and chimneys. The garbage men make noise and yell to each other on the street. My father gets up, goes to the window, looks down at them. They are busy, he says. That's good. Do something. Hunting lizards in the dark. During the killings unaware, we walked along the lakes. You spoke of Beethoven. I studied a rock picking at a dog shit. Each of us caught up in ourselves, surrounded by a shell of ignorance that protects our prejudices. The holies believe that a butterfly in the Himalaya with a flap of a wing can influence a climate in Antarctica. It may be true, but where the tanks roll in and flesh and blood of human beings drip from the trees, that is no comfort. Searching for truth is like hunting lizards in the dark. The grapes are from South Africa. The rice from Pakistan. The dates grown in Iran. We support the idea of open borders for fruit and vegetables. But however we twist and turn, the ass is at the back. The dead are buried deep inside the newspaper so that we, unaffected, can sit on a bench on the outskirts of paradise and dream of butterflies. And then a poem about the poets. Hard life to be a poet. In defense of poets, what are we to do about the poets? Life is rough on them. They look so pitiful dressed in black, their skin blue from internal blizzards. Poetry is a horrible disease. The infected walk about complaining. Their scream pollute the atmosphere like leaks from atomic power stations of the mind. It's so psychotic. Poetry is a tyrant. It keeps people awake at night and destroys marriages. It draws people out to desolate cutters in midwinter where they sit in pain wearing earmuffs and dig scarves. Imagine the torture. Poetry is a pest worse than gonorrhea, a terrible abomination. But consider poets, it's hard for them. Bear with them. They are hysterical as if they are expecting twins. They gnash their teeth while sleeping. They eat dirt and grass. They stay out in the howling wind for hours, tormented by astounding metaphors. Every day is a holy day for them. Oh, please take pity on the poets. They are deaf and blind. Help them through traffic where they stagger about with their invisible handicap. Remembering all sorts of stuff. Now and then one of them stops to listen for a distant siren. Show consideration for them. Poets are like insane children who have been chased from home by the entire family. Pray for them. They are born unhappy. Their mothers have cried for them. Such is the assistance of doctors and lawyers. Until they had to give up for fear of losing their own minds. Oh, cry for the poets. Nothing can save them. Infested with poetry like secret lepers, they are incarcerated in their own fantasy world, a grousome ghetto filled with demons and vindictive ghosts. When on a clear summer's day, the sun shining brightly, you see a poor poet come wobbling out of the apartment block, looking pale like a cadaver and disfigured by speculations. Then walk up and help him. Tie his shoelaces. Lead him to the park and help him sit down on a bench in the sun. Sing to him a little. Buy him an ice cream. And tell him a story. Because he is so sad. He is completely ruined by poetry. And finally, I'll end with a small encouragement for all of us. Isn't it an uplifting thought that in a few decades from now, we, in this whole confused epoch, with its retarded president, worn-out arguments, mawkish TV host, dim journalist, and the whole kibitzer lustig jubilant choir will be gone for all time. We will disappear. They will disappear. I will disappear. You will disappear. It will all disappear. Hooray! Thank you.
One of the delights of my year was a little poke and a prod from my friend Di Brandt, who's a poet that I admire very much and a poet who reads very broadly and with great passion. And she checked in one day and said, "I really, really want you to bring George Ellenbogen." And I said, "I don't know George Ellenbogen. Should I know George Ellenbogen?" She said, "If you don't know George Ellenbogen, you're in for a treat." So I got on my little email network and I got hold of George's publisher of his upcoming book and said, I really need to see some George Ellenbogen because I'm thinking I'll invite him to the festival. And I got this email back with a piece of manuscript. It was just attached to email, which is really no way to read a book. And I clicked it open and looked at page 7, and I looked at page 13, and I looked at page 25, and I was just lifted out of my seat. So although George Ellenbogen is not a new poet, he's new to me. I suspect he may be new to some of you. He's a Montrealer who has lived for a long time in Boston. Please welcome him here tonight.
First, I'd like to thank Charlene and all those associated with this festival for managing it so skillfully. I'd like to add my appreciation to that of all the other writers who've read here. This first poem, Homecoming, started for me with the opening take of a film based on a novel by Mordecai Richler, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. The opening take, a high school band marching out of step with uniforms a couple of sizes too large for them. And the poem set in World War II anticipates these kids growing into these uniforms and the fate that's waiting for them. Homecoming. Can you hear me, by the way? Okay. Whenever I saw Harry Flatt pumping notes through his tuba, the clump of them taking off like a goony bird plopping on his gold epaulettes, and Harry hopping to keep in step in the homecoming parade, I knew the sky had opened for redemption, for all of us, for the droolers and nose pickers, even Harry, who would crawl up to heaven on all fours or get sucked up, his hair standing like a corn crop. And the band marked time, notes slicked down like an old Ford stuck in second gear, except they weren't stuck, and jolted on in whites and reds as red as fireplugs, until it broke up at Howard's, where sodas spilled over glass, and everyone laughed like hussars. It was 40 or 41 when the letters came, typed up from the board, and the whole band signed up, even Harry Flatt, hair rising like an expectation, and the war kissed them, even the sophisticates from Leopard Hill and Lafayette, laid them down like children and spread an eternity of white crosses like corn seed in longer and longer rows, and the birds flew north, whole flocks of them, and never stopped, not even for crumbs. This next poem, Night Train to Zagreb, started for me in a night train to Zagreb in one of those typical European train compartments with several sleeping areas, one of which was occupied by a woman with a missing forearm. And I remember being horrified when I was told about how that had come to pass and very much wanting to record it, to get something down on paper. But as often happens with an incident that's as overwhelming as that, nothing happened. I got nothing down. And I kept coming back to the incident from time to time over the years with the same empty results. And it wasn't until about 8 years later that the poem came quickly in one sitting. But curiously enough, the details as they had been related to me 8 years earlier had become muddied. I couldn't remember, for example, whether the woman was a Serb who had lost her limb as a result of a Croatian raid on her village or the reverse. And it bugs the narrator, who keeps asking questions like, was it here? Was it there? Was it this? Was it that? Which for me are less important than the major question, the major issue, the mindlessness, the intensity of the violence. So much so that the means of communicating the experience, language in the largest sense, down to the smallest components, the thumbtacks of language, vowels, consonants, dissolve, drift away, as if to suggest that language lacks the capacity to render such an experience. Night Train to Zagreb. When gusts spread against the glass on the Orient Express to Zagreb, snow separates in alphabet. The vowels clinging to glass, consonants slipping into drifts. It must be this way for the howl to flatten a summons against the pain, the moaning against the arms of night, pushing it beneath unbroken meters of the train. Inside, one hand reaches for coffee, the other sleeve reaches the table, armless, turning in circles like a pendulum, raising questions as the train turns through the foothills. It was a Serb. Or was it a Croat who came out of a night like this with candlesticks, something in a bag, and she was there, something between the doorway and road? Or was it the bedroom and kitchen? And he lowered to her as if to leave something behind, a kiss or something more memorable. We always misunderstand. And her arm was in the snow, possibly on a night like this, with less to understand than ice caking on glass over a broken-toothed moan in alphabet that never shapes. That poem came out of a trip to Yugoslavia in 1978, at a point when the various peoples of Yugoslavia were living more or less peaceably together. And scarcely 12 years later, people who were neighbors suddenly found themselves slaughtering one another, which is the substance of this next poem, In Time of the Breaking of Bosnia. Having the benefit of habit, they kill more happily in these parts, like undressing lambs for Easter. The local eccentric faults the mountains, rising by circular roadways to an empty chapel. Yesterday, an assault on a village, its name mounded under anonymities of haystacks. Today it's Ilam's peasants, shot and stacked like harvested hay. Newspapers repeat the equations. A rapes B, B murders C, D the unknown in the algebra of retribution. What remains are stunted walls, roof fragments, shreds of diplomatic regrets from the capitals, fouled wells, fractions that scrape the skin into attention, the eye into regarding. I want to stroke this sadness like a lame bird in my hand, smooth its feathers towards flight, but it always perches beyond my reach. My garden, beyond the puffs of smoke, the firing, announces the adolescence of early summer. Sons of Wyrr, pausing on legs before moving on, like inchworms, not yet instructive. No eclipse yet, tremor or rumble of thunder to teach or suggest death will become more intrusive in our lives, a tennis partner who shows up by surprise and never allows a pause for lemonade, serving now for the match. When I'm back home, which is in Boston, I tend to do a lot of my work on Cape Cod at a place called Sheep Pond. And whenever I look out the window towards the lake, my eye fastens on two trees, one coniferous, the other deciduous. And every couple of years, we get a gypsy caterpillar siege. And the deciduous tree becomes a matter of concern, whether it will survive or not. So the poem is ostensibly about a couple of trees, but I think it reaches to other issues, such as what we can control and what we can't control. Twin trees at Sheep Pond. Only the hair unsettles us. A crew cut of needles on one declares it will survive. Acquire seasons of growth. Graduate the way pines do, even here on this powdery incline. The other gives us fits each fall after the caterpillar siege, when it leans over water, curling towards mortality as if seeking a transfusion of God knows what, where water's speech glints late falls, darkening skies, and twigs bare shudder as wind guides the temperatures down. Water knows the stillness that's ahead, moves incessantly like children released from school, rushing from the reach of darkness. We'll wait on the tree to acquire its heft, the way we always wait for the other child who has stared at the sky for too long and is running to catch up and never does. An early poem, Frozen White, about drifting apart, built around images of snow and ice, which suggest for me a positioning into separateness. A reference to Decamps, which is a French dessert wine, Chateau Decamps, very expensive dessert wine. Frozen White. Have you ever noticed on a day when ice cuts through wind and spears across the lake, that you don't touch her hand across the sheet, the white, full, frozen, and you don't reach across two glasses of Decamps, and you don't touch her reaching phrase, but let it drop into the twisted poles of the hooked rug, and you don't even stare at the fire as the cold pushes at the outside hinges, and snow barrels down the roof, drifting up the windows. And you don't. And you don't. And you don't. Thank you.
Those beautiful poems are from Morning Gothic. It's a gorgeous book.